From the studios of KPCW, it's Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's fun and accessible. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. I'm here with John Wells. And this morning, our first guest is Stephen Johnson. He is the best-selling author of many books on the intersection of science, technology, and personal experience. He brings us the book Wonderland and argues that observers of technological and social trends should be looking for clues in novel amusements. You'll find the future wherever people are having the most fun. It's a book that surveys the history of innovation throughout time.
Good morning, Lynn, and happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Then we're going to move from digital design to engineering. Park City students, they find themselves immersed in the real world in the PC Center for Advanced Professional Studies. Hey, we need an acronym. PC CAPS, that's probably how you know it. And we're joined by two students, one teacher and one mentor, who are navigating the waters in this unique program that brings high school kids into contact with solving the actual problems and creating the innovative solutions for the future.
This is Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
Support for KPCW comes from the Crandall family, owners of the New Park Amphitheater, site of the New Park Concert Series, and numerous other community events.
G'day. This is Ashley from Campus Coffee, happy to sponsor programming on KPCW. We can't wait to serve the Park City locals this winter. We're excited by our breakfast and lunch menu to complement our espresso drinks. Campos Coffee is open daily at the base of Park City Mountain Resort, up the stairs from the ice rink next to the Adirondack chairs. CamposCoffee.com.
Hello, this is Diane Reinhart with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. We are a proud supporter of KPCW and have been providing our clients with real estate services since 1976. All current and active listings can be found on our website at bhhsutah.com, and our agents can help navigate the real estate market.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. Our first guest, Stephen Johnson, writes widely on topics that have influenced everything from the way political campaigns use the internet to cutting-edge ideas in urban planning to the battle against 21st century terrorism. In 2010, he was chosen by Prospect magazine as one of the top 10 brains of the digital future. Stephen Johnson has written a book called Wonderland, and his premise is this: the cutting edge of innovation lies wherever people are working the hardest to keep themselves and others amused. Johnson introduces us to the colorful innovators of leisure, the explorers, proprietors, the showmen, and artists who changed really the trajectory of history with their luxurious wares, their exotic meals, taverns, gambling tables, and magic shows. Stephen Johnson, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
I just want to start with this little bio of yours. You're the best-selling author of 10 books, including How We Got to Now, Where Good Ideas Come From, The Invention of Air, and others. You're also the host and co-creator of a PBS and BBC series called How We Got to Now. So you have been pretty innovative yourself, I think, in taking your little corner of the world in which curiosity has really determined the path, and you now you're sharing it with others.
Yeah, it's, you know, one of the best things, looking back on my career, now that I'm an old, I'm about to turn 50, so it's appropriate for me to start looking. I just have been able to, for whatever reason, I've been able to kind of follow the sometimes somewhat unpredictable kind of path of my curiosity, and have been able to basically write books on this, whatever things I started to get obsessed with. And it's been, as you kind of can tell from those titles, you know, I mean, I've written books about cholera in the 19th century and 18th century chemistry and invention of air and video games and all these different topics. And for some reason, my publishers keep letting me do this. And it's really fun. It really is one of the best things about my work, is that I get to just follow these trails of interest wherever they lead.
And it's interesting, on our show, Cool Science Radio, we try to create the science curious. You know, we may be lay people, but really developing curiosity is the key to a lot of learning. And then, as you explain in your book, to innovation. What do you say to those people who ask you at a cocktail party, you know, how is it that you're so curious?
Well, it's funny. When I was younger, before I had kids, I now have three boys, two of whom are teenagers now. Before I had kids, I was like, when I have kids, I really want them to be just obsessive, like curious kids. You know, they get obsessed with something. They want to know everything they can about it. And I don't really care what it is, but I want them to have a series of obsessions, right? Because that's the kind of kid I was. Like, I would get really into something, and I'd learn everything I could about it, and then I would move on to something else. And some of them were really frivolous things. It was like dice baseball games, and then it was magic tricks or whatever it was. But that feeling of getting, you know, so enmeshed in something that you have to know everything there is about it is a really great kind of intellectual resource, I think, to have. And to get that kind of passion and curiosity is really important. And it doesn't really matter what you're focused on, as long as you develop that appetite in a way. And so, but in the kind of be careful what you wish for department, my kids turned out to be exactly like that. Only there was an earlier phase they went through when they were younger where they were obsessed with luxury yachts.
Yeah.
And I was like, but that's a stupid thing to be obsessed. Why are you reading luxury yacht magazine? That is terrible. That's just what a waste of time and money.
Don't be curious about that.
That's what a lot of Wonderland is about. It's about people getting pulled into something without a clear sense of why it's useful. You know, a lot we tend to think about innovation is coming from, and scientific breakthroughs is coming from people being like, now I must solve the problem of, you know, how to make our crops more productive so that we can feed more people. And sometimes that is what drives innovation, and that's a great part of the history, and that's what we've traditionally taught. But there's a whole other side of it, which is driven by kind of open-ended exploration and curiosity and sometimes just delight and amusement, where people get interested in something just because it's cool. I mean, on some level, to take a cool science kind of idea. And in that exploration, in large part because they're drawn to new things and new experiences, because that's surprising and delightful. Old things are less delightful because we've already seen them. So they're drawn into these new experiences. And in exploring these new experiences or technologies or whatever it is, they actually end up stumbling across important ideas that change the world and improve the world. But it starts with something that seems initially kind of frivolous and playful and almost like a waste of time. And so that's what Wonderland is, an attempt to kind of do a big sweeping catalog of all the different I couldn't even do all of them because there's so many. You could write a book based on every chapter in this book.
Yeah.
But at least give some sense of how important that pursuit of play and delight and wonder has been in human history.
Okay, so I should sort of go in a chronological order here, but I'm going to jump way ahead to virtual reality because something you said a moment ago made me think that I'm one of those people who has failed to see how something that's just fun and seemingly frivolous can go in various directions. And I would say that, you know, we have the Sundance Film Festival here in Park City each year, and that's how a lot of us were exposed to virtual reality. Each year they have this little showcase of virtual reality. And the first time I went, I don't know, more than a decade ago, I thought, well, that's kind of cool, but I don't see the usefulness in that. So could you talk for a bit about virtual reality and sort of what it started off as and where it's gone?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I kind of adapted a little bit of a section. There's a chapter in Wonderland about illusion and the history of basically optical illusions that goes back to things like the stereogram and things like that, like the kaleidoscope and things, you know, kind of early 19th century technologies that predate, virtual reality by 200 years or so. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that, if you'd gone back to London, say 200 years ago, and walked around the streets of London, you would have found there were all these kind of palaces of illusion that were doing all these different kinds of tricks to create the sense that you were immersed in a kind of fantasy space of some kind. So, you know, you had theater, the way we would recognize it today, but you also had things like the Phantasmagoria, which was this kind of multimedia spook show where you'd go in and there would be, magic lantern effects making you feel like you were in a haunted house, and there would be smoke machines, and there would be actually electrical shocks that would be delivered to you, which is a little alarming.
Just for kicks.
But then there was also the panorama where you have this giant 360-degree paintings that you kind of immerse yourself in. And there are just dozens of other things like that, and they're all simulations of military battles with these little kind of robots and indoor fireworks and things like that. I mean, all these things basically got wiped out by the cinema. You know, there were all these experiments with how do you fool people into thinking they're in another world, and then we invented the movies, and they all just got killed off, basically. But I think what virtual reality suggests is that maybe they will have a kind of a second act, you know, two centuries later. But what's striking about all of those technologies and those experiences 200 years ago is that they really weren't stories. And this is a kind of adapted this into a Times Magazine piece. I was talking about this in the context of virtual reality. Like when you go back and look at what people were amused by in these illusion palaces, there weren't really characters. There wasn't a sense of like, now, you know, let's introduce you to this conflict between these three characters and follow their story over time. You just were put into an environment. And what was intense and captivating about it was the sense of just the space and exploring the space. It wasn't about following a story arc. And I think that may be ultimately what we end up doing with virtual reality as an art form, is that it's less Hollywood and the novel are great at telling stories. Virtual reality is really almost closer to architecture in a way. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, like if you were going to make Titanic in VR, you actually wouldn't bother with the story of the scrappy young painter and the young woman of means bearing into a bad marriage, all that kind of stuff. You just want to run around the ship.
Yeah,
You just want to be there. And I think we're going to learn that will be the art form, will be like creating these immersive worlds that aren't particularly about stories, because stories will just, in a sense, seem to get in the way.
Yeah, not about stories, more about experiencing all of your senses.
Yeah. Exactly.
Interesting. Okay, well, let's then go backward in time to your introduction. And at this point in time, the most civilized urban environment on the planet, I think, would surprise people. Where was that?
It was Baghdad.
Yeah.
At the height of the Islamic Renaissance, the Islamic Golden Age, a little more than 1,000 years ago. And, Baghdad was an incredibly civilized city, really the seat of kind of scholarship in the world, really, for that period. And there was a really interesting institution there, which had a great name. It was called the House of Wisdom.
Yes.
And it was kind of a mix of a engineering, almost like a maker lab, in some ways, we would call it now, but also kind of a translation bureau, kind of a think tank. And there were a bunch of people doing these really cutting-edge engineering work in the House of Wisdom, and they published a series of books which also had great titles, like The Book of Ingenious Devices. And if you go through these books, you see that they have these beautiful, there's some of them are reproduced in full color in Wonderland, beautiful illustrations with kind of schematics of their contraptions that they've designed. And there's some extraordinarily advanced engineering work that's going on there. Some clocks that are more reliable than any clocks that Europe would see for another 500 years. There are these hydraulic systems, float valves, all these complicated ideas that were well ahead of their time. But the other thing that's striking looking at this book is all of the devices in the book, basically, almost without exception, are toys. They're all just these little, kind of amusing objects, little automata, little kind of almost like mechanical dolls, and there are little mechanical elephants, and there's, you pull the tail of the peacock and its little head sticks out, or they make music and they're music boxes. And so you have this interesting thing which really sets the whole tone for the entire book, of some of the most advanced engineering in the world devoted to making toys.
Right.
And, And one of those things, actually, in another book that was almost lost to history, which is maybe the most important one of all, was another device made during this period. It was called the instrument that plays itself. And the instrument was basically a music box. It controlled a mechanical kind of automated flute player. There's a whole theme in the book about flutes, which is very strange. But the whole thing was like a music box in the sense that it was controlled by a rotating cylinder that had pins on it corresponding to the notes and the length of the notes that were being played, just like a little music box would have.
Right.
And what made this technology so revolutionary is that you could remove the cylinder and cut basically a new cylinder with different notes on it and put it back in, and you would create a whole new, it would play a totally different song with different movements and so on. And this was really the first programmable machine in history. It was the first machine where it was controlled by code on some level that you could swap out. If you wanted it to do something else, you could write different code and it would behave in a different way. And so, again, it's just a music box flute player. It's not doing any complicated problem solving, but the whole idea of kind of the distinction between hardware and software,
right,
that shapes so much of the modern world today, is for the first time kind of imaginable through this device. So it's a really, and that was, you know, 1,200 years ago in Baghdad.
The first computer, a music box in Baghdad. Wow, that's really incredible. Talk also about some of the other little devices that were created. I'm stuck on the float valve that was far, you know, hundreds of years before the modern toilet that was discovered in this book of ingenious devices, I assume?
Yeah, they had all these, they did a lot of stuff with hydraulics, right? And they had lots of kind of water driven, and the clocks that they used, and this is somewhat beyond my technical understanding, but they had water clocks, basically. They would use water to regulate time as well. But they all, you know, they had one little guy that would kind of bring out, there was a little kind of virtual servant, and it could be automated, and he would bring out a little bar of soap that you could then take from him, and then he would come back. They looked, it was a little bit like, they look like kind of cuckoo clocks now. And in fact, they then inspired a whole generation of engineers later in Europe who inherited kind of a lot of these ideas. And then there was a really profound wave of mechanical toys that developed in the 1700s in Paris and in England, in Paris and London. And my favorite one of those was this creature created by the French inventor, Jacques de Vaucanson, that was known as the defecating duck. And the defecating duck was this basically anatomically correct duck that would waddle around and quack, but was entirely mechanical. And you could feed it pellets of actual food, and it had a whole mechanical kind of inner
digestion
system that would actually process the food and then expel it out on the other end of the duck.
And this was for fun. This was a toy.
This was the you know, the Parisian elite would sit around in their salons. And I, you know, I joke, this was like the PlayStation of the,
right,
of the 17th century, you know, or the 18th century.
Oh, that's fun. That's really good stuff. Well, you go on to this chapter in which you talk about spices and taste. And I thought it was interesting because you started off talking about Doritos. And I thought, oh, well, Doritos came from, of course, from scientists sitting around putting different chemicals together and coming up with something that by some people's standards is edible.
Yeah.
But then you launch into talk of spices. So how is it that spices and around the world were included in your book? And specifically, you've got a great graphic of nutmeg taken from the late 1700s.
Yeah. So there's, first off, with the Doritos, you know, one of the things that I found within the book is I actually kind of analyzed the ingredients list of Doritos, which is famously long. There was an old parody in The Onion where they had a headline that read, "Doritos celebrates its 1 millionth ingredient." But when you look down this list, there's all, you know, if you actually kind of break down where all these, you know, there's a bit of tomato and then there's cheese, some kind of cheese and Romano cheese, I think, I can't remember the whole list. But if you break down where all these foods and flavors came from, it's an entirely global palate, like where they originally, where the crop that led to them originally came from. It is a true creature of the world. I mean, it comes from, you know, I think like five continents and, you know, just all of it. This is from South America and this is from Central America and this is from Asia and so on. And we take that for granted because our palates are now, you know, very much global in the flavors we and actual foods that we expect to eat. But that was not always the case. And what really made that global, the kind of global table, the global refrigerator possible originally was spices.
Mm.
And in fact, in some sense, the global economy was made, you know, not just about flavor and food. It's about the fact that we live in a multinational economy now. Spice drove that as much as anything. And this is one of these things where, you know, you're taught that as a kid, right? I mean, my kids are, you know, taking world history classes now in high school, and, you know, they're talking about the spice trade was really big. But I don't remember at any point when I was in high school stopping, you know, having my teacher stop and say, think about how weird that is, right? I mean, pepper, for instance, was, you know, for a while, the most valuable kind of resource in the world. It was worth its weight, certainly in silver and potentially worth its weight in gold. And, you know, a huge amount of the navigation of the globe, I mean, Columbus included, was set about in pursuit of pepper and cinnamon mm-hmm. and nutmeg. And that's fascinating because these things are by definition not about sustenance, right? They're not about nutrition. Nobody died because they didn't get enough pepper. They're all about the kind of delightful play of flavors on your tongue. There was kind of a myth that was spread that the people who were driving the spice trade needed the spices in order to eat meat that was basically not edible anymore because it was, you know, so it somehow kept people alive because they could spice up this old meat. But there's been a lot of scholarship in this that apparently is really not true. The people who were driving the spice trade were wealthy enough to have access to plenty of edible meat. They were driven to spend all this money on spices because they liked the taste of it. They thought it was just interesting. It wasn't functional. It was just interesting and new. Mm-hmm. And it suggested the flavors of another part of the world. And there was something interesting about being able to taste, you know, the remote regions of India while you were sitting down to eat your meal in London. And so here you have this, a massive transformation of the globe. And by the way, you know, both the interconnectedness of a multinational world, but also some of the worst abuses of, slavery and colonization during that period. It's not just a good story. All being driven by the sense of kind of the delight of new flavors. It's just a great reminder of how important, how much of our history has been shaped by those kinds of experiences.
Right, right. I want to go back to... I mean, along the same thread, though, there's the how our history and our innovation is shaped by these types of experiences. When you're talking about some of the engineering feats from centuries ago, you make engineering sound very creative and innovative. And I think that now, you know, modern day, we do encourage our children to go off and study, become engineers because it's a great job and you'll always have a job. And yet we're worried about our kids becoming too, you know, narrowly focused and it's rote and it's not very creative. And we have that sense of it. But I have a feeling that you have a completely different idea about it. And I would love for, you know, my child who is in college studying engineering to read this book.
Well, I fully encourage that. I think that's a great idea. But yeah, it's about, you know, it's about the playful side of, in some sense, the playful side of STEM, right?
Right.
And this is where you can see it with, in terms of the engineering things like Lego robotics, or in terms of programming, things like the Scratch programming language that Mitch Resnick developed at MIT, where, you know, you're learning programming skills. There's a new great programming thing that Apple has called Swift Playgrounds. I love that they call it Playgrounds, is how you learn how to program in this new language, Swift. Because it looks like a game. I mean, you really are in there, and you're sitting there kind of solving these puzzles in this world, and somebody looking over your shoulder would think you're playing a video game, but in fact, you're learning very high-level programming that will allow you to then go and, you know, write applications for, you know, the iPhone. And I think that actually is a huge part of the history. I mean, I talk in the book, in the games chapter, about the first video game ever, which is this game called Space War that was developed in the early 1960s and kind of spread through the growing computer science world in the 60s from, you know, university to university. And you can make the argument that Space War was one of the most important pieces of software written in the 60s because it was since one of the first open source software applications. People developed unique hardware for it that in some ways were the predecessor of the computer mouse. But most importantly, it enabled people to realize for the first time that computers were not just going to be this austere kind of bureaucratic, box that was used only by accounting firms in the military. That people were going to have a much more creative relationship with their computers, and they were going to have fun with their computers. And it was actually watching people playing Space War that Stuart Brand famously came up with the term the personal computer itself. That idea that we would have this personal connection to the computer, the PC, now that comes directly from Stuart Brand watching people play Space War. And so, you know, there is, you can learn a lot in tinkering with these things. Look, there is, you know, when you learn how to program, when you're learning the kind of physics you need to do actual real world engineering, it's tough. There are times where it doesn't feel fun. But I think there are ways to kind of teach these things, and also people should have the expectation that you can take these fields and actually have fun in them. And if we're not having fun in them, we're kind of doing them wrong.
That's right. Well, it's a fun and delightful read. The book is Wonderland, How Play Made the Modern World. And Stephen, for those of us who are heading off on a road trip, is this an audiobook yet?
Yeah, I believe it is. I didn't read it, but I believe somebody else did. So it won't be my voice, but yes, I'm pretty sure there is an audiobook. Sorry about that.
Excellent. Well, Stephen Johnson, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Again, that was Stephen Johnson. Very interesting individual, I must say. And stay tuned. We'll be back with some more interesting individuals. We'll be joined by the students, teacher and mentor of the PC CAPS program. That's the Park City Center for Advanced Professional Studies program at Park City High School. It's Cool Science Radio. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
This is Courtney Johansson with the Spur Bar and Grill, and we're happy to support KPCW. We are located at 352 Main Street and serve breakfast, lunch, dinner, drinks, and dancing. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. with live music every night. More information at thespurbarandgrill.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peak. We were just speaking with Stephen Johnson, his book called Wonderland, How Play Made the Modern World. Our next guest, you're gonna love this. If you expose young minds to opportunities to expand the desire for creativity and innovation, well, you're going to see their future unrolling in front of them in their eyes. If you line them up with people, adults already in the field of engineering, software, and digital design and business, it'll boost their confidence and help them see a possible future career and give them an experience to boot. PC CAPS, or Center for Advanced Professional Studies program at Park City High School, does just that. And joining us to talk about the program and some of the projects are a couple of students, a teacher, and a mentor from the business world. From the world of digital design, we will speak with Shelby Porges, a digital design student, and her teacher, Deb Corrigan. Then we'll be joined by Mitch Vandegutsch, I think I pronounced that correctly, an engineer who mentors students, and Jordan Stampley, the computer science student. Welcome all of you to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, and we're going to start with Shelby and Deb. Tell us about the collaboration that you have between the two of you.
So as my teacher, Ms. Corrigan, has been a great influence on all the projects I have done. I am working with 4 projects, and she has given me the opportunity to work with multiple clients and just get the experience needed for this program.
And when did you first get excited about digital design?
I've always loved the design world, and I want to pursue it in my future, and I think PC Caps is a wonderful experience to just get ahead in that, and because it's a hands-on experience with this program. And it's a reality check of what I want to do in the real world.
So the digital design world, is it just an evolution of graphic design, meaning that now we're using, I don't even know the programs, Illustrator and
Adobe,
so on?
Yeah.
Yes.
So a lot of people think that logos are made just like with writing on a piece of paper. But actually, PC Caps, we work with Adobe Illustrator. We even work with like Photoshop. But it's a lot of like work with the computers, actually. Mm-hmm. And it brings the logo, something concrete to the eye where you can print out, you can manipulate, and you can show it to your clients when it's the final project.
So I know that at least one of your projects, Shelby, is something that we see regularly around town. And this is one that you worked on in collaboration with the city, I believe.
Yes, PC Muni. As you probably know, Park City wants to go green. We are working with electric buses. And they came to us, PC Municipal came to us and asked if we could brand them. So we have come up with multiple names for their new company, PC Municipal. Instead of PC Green, they want something else because green is just used over and over mm-hmm. and over. So then we also made some logos, probably 4, would you say?
Four to five
logos, and they took them, and they are considering them for sure.
And Deb Corrigan, also known as Miss Corrigan, you are a teacher within the high school.
Yes.
So the PC Caps programs, when you're assigning a teacher to a student, those are always teachers from the high school, or are they from the outside ever? How does the whole thing work?
We often use mentors from the real world. We try to do that to give the kids an experience not only on something like a portfolio piece, but on soft skills, professional communication, and being able to have that responsibility working with adults. We've done things from website design to branding to video apps. So we're really excited about the variety of work that we're able to produce. And it's not necessarily one single mentor or one single project that we're working on. The kids are juggling. We don't have a lot of downtime. We don't like downtime. And they like the variety. It gives them a little bit of break and a little bit more chance to explore different avenues.
When you say juggling, you're talking about disciplines other than, in this case, digital design.
Yes, it does all fall under digital design, and it is an expansion of what we traditionally called graphic design. It just now is involving more the computer and the connectivity with the global, you know, the global world. So it involves a lot more.
So I'm wondering, Deb, as a teacher in the high school, do you teach similar courses? And how do you bridge that? What's it like for a teacher to be in a sort of regular classroom setting and then in PC Caps where... by design, it's completely different, or
right.
It's supposed to be, I think.
It is. And yes, I do teach digital media, traditional CTE digital media at the high school, which is great because they are able to work within the same space as the PC Caps kids. They get excited. They see our projects. They work with the equipment, really state-of-the-art equipment that we have. And I'm able to recruit from that digital media class. In fact, we've grown the program a lot because of that.
Mm. Now, operating in the professional world, I think as parents, we try to teach our kids as they're growing up, now look Mr. Smith in the eye and shake his hand and, you know, that sort of thing. And make sure before you leave the party, you say thank you. But I found, because my son went through PC CAPS, that something that was a valuable lesson is, you know, even adults don't always answer emails and things like that. And so what are some, and either of you can answer this, what are some of those little things that you've learned? And don't be afraid to disparage adults, because, you know, sometimes we have issues with follow through as well, because only because we're so busy. Right, John?
Of course.
Well, one thing that I do remind the students of is they get very personal. Everything they produce is a piece of them. Mm-hmm. And I try to bring them back to the fact that this is business, and this is the business world, and design is subjective. So it may be, don't get your feelings hurt if your logo isn't chosen or they don't get back with us right away. It's part of the real world.
So don't take things personally. Boy, that's a lesson that you work on your entire life. So Shelby, what would you say about those kinds of lessons that you've learned that were sort of unexpected?
I would definitely agree with Ms. Corrigan about the not being too, like, don't get so personal about them. Because I have learned the hard way. I get very connected to my logos. And if they don't get chosen, then I get really hard on myself. Also, since day one of PC CAPS, we always have to dress professionally. We have to have great mannerism. We have to be polite, not only towards our teachers, but to the clients. We have to meet those expectations. And, of course, you want to do that in school with all your core classes, science, math, etc. But with this really is your reputation, and you want to exceed to that.
It seems to me that maybe 20 years ago, the Fortune 1000 type company was very interested in branding their company, branding their products. It's kind of a brave new world where everybody is concerned about branding today. It kind of indicates to me that this is a tremendous opportunity for digital design people, professionals. How would you counsel Ms. Corrigan, on how to differentiate yourself from the pack, because there's a lot of design engineers out there, a lot of digital design people out there.
I believe everyone has a distinct style. I've actually been working with a lot of mountains through my logos. And it's all, Ms. Corrigan has always told me, be simple with your logos, because you don't want to be so complex or else it would mix up the point of the logo. What would you say, Ms. Corrigan?
I think that just the opportunity to have portfolio pieces, real, tangible, and they're connecting with them. When they are working with an organic dog food company, they're excited to get that GoPro harness on their dog, go out and shoot some video, and they are doing that even outside of our 3-hour class period because they care. And it's those kinds of things, I think, that make a difference to a kid. Yes, they care about a grade, but some tangible portfolio piece is something that they just, you cannot duplicate that on paper.
And when she gets out there in the real world, how would you counsel her on how to be within a design shop where there are lots of people and you can learn all the different chops? Or a lot of people start out and they go off on their own, but it's more difficult to understand what that entire industry is about.
I feel like the world is going towards more collaboration. And we talk a lot about being a design team and borrowing elements from each other. So again, nothing really is ours. We are doing it for each other, for the project, for the client, and for the end result.
Okay, final question, then we'll switch over to this other team that we've got waiting here in the wings. But Shelby, I wanted to ask you, are you a senior?
I'm a junior.
You're a junior. Okay, so you're thinking about college at this point,
yes.
I would assume. You've probably been thinking about it for a few years. It seems like kids in Park City do. And so how much is this helping you in terms of, you know, we talked about a portfolio. Is that, I mean, are you going to go in this digital design field and want to major in that in college, and how is it going to help you?
Like I said, I have always been interested in the design world ever since I was little. I've just loved like putting shapes together, mm-hmm. colors, etc. I feel this will exactly like bring give me a portfolio to show to colleges. I have actually been looking at colleges, which one, like, what are the best ones that have the best design program. I want to continue that in my future, not just inside of school, but outside of college, and pursue that in my future.
Which are those colleges you've earmarked? I'm curious.
I am looking at USD, USC, Point Loma, just multiple colleges in California. Uh-huh. I love it. and I think that would be an amazing experience.
Going to the beach for college wouldn't be that bad.
Yeah.
Good.
All right. Well, best of luck.
Thank you.
And Ms. Corrigan, thank you for joining
us
as well. And we're going to take a quick underwriting break and switch microphones, and we'll be back with Jordan Stamfli and Mitch Vandegooch. Close anyway, when we return. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Shelley Barris, Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity. Have you been to our ReStore lately? You will find treasures every visit because we receive new donations of furniture, appliances, and building materials daily. Even better, your purchases support local hardworking families. We are a nonprofit and proud to be a KPCW supporter.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We are here with some folks from PC CAPS program. We're just speaking with Deb Corrigan, who is a teacher within Park City High School for digital design, and Shelby Porges, who's a digital design student. Now joining us, Mitch Vandegooch, who is an engineer who mentors students within PC CAPS, and Jordan Stamfli, who is a computer science student. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Very, very pleased to have you here. The PC CAPS program has gotten a lot of attention. Tell us about some of the projects that you work on. And Mitch, for you, is this the only student that you're mentoring, or are you mentoring a group of students?
So I'm actually mentoring a group of students in the engineering program. Jordan's actually, he's in the computer science program. So I don't actually mentor him directly. We do kind of, some of my engineering students do work with Jordan as well. So.
And there's lots of advice, there's lots of counsel that you give the students that you work with. What are some of the top maybe three or four things that you tell them from your own experience out in the real world?
You know, the whole opportunity I have to mentor students, and that's my whole goal in that, is giving them the knowledge that I've learned of, you know, it's just real world experience, and taking what you've learned and translating that into the business standpoint. So I think kind of like what they touched on earlier, it's also, it's being, you know, doing your best work, but not taking it personally. And in the end, you know, there's meetings, there's emails that you won't hear back from, but it's just applying everything that you've, taken in, but it translates a little different in the business standpoint.
But there's not a top one or two things that you give all students for advice?
I would say, I mean, no matter what I do, I would say probably do your best at things, you know, and put your best effort to it. And I would say that's probably one of the top things, because kind of, I guess, like Shelby said, it is your reputation at the same time. People remember how you work.
We spoke a bit off air before you came on, and you were an engineer for Skull Candy for some time, and now you're sort of going off on your own, but maybe taking some time off that maybe you didn't after college, or, you know, maybe you went right into your career. So that is another thing that, you know, so many kids now are taking a gap year, or, you know, there are a variety of ways of sort of approaching your career. Do you feel like, you know, is that insight that you share with the kids?
Oh, definitely. This is my first year mentoring with PC CAPS. And I remember the first day I walked in, I remember it was like my college senior design class. And I was like, you guys are having, this is an awesome, unique opportunity that you're getting in high school. And then I do share with the experiences I've had. I mean, I've had different industrial design jobs. I've had consumer design jobs. And as you said, I'm trying to take an entrepreneurial step now. So that's what I'm sharing is, like, there's so many different routes you guys can go with whether it's engineering or computer science that, you know, follow your dreams. If you have the hard work, if you do your best, you can make whatever happen.
Yeah, that's great. It must be wonderfully relevant for them to hear that sort of thing from someone other than their parents. What do you think about that, Jordan? And come on up to the mic there.
Well, I would say that getting sort of like a separate viewpoint, because obviously your parents are going to have, like, you know, they're very invested in you. So I think talking to people who do things that you may or may not want to do in the future, but you're sort of headed towards, is big, because they can give you a lot more specific advice that is a lot more objective, rather than just, like, maybe telling you that, like, if you work hard, you can do it, because obviously there will be obstacles that you're going to have to cross.
Because you're a computer science student, you obviously take classes within the high school, and you, you know, you're reading books, and you've got hands-on, and you probably do some programming and things like that. Now that Mitch has been introduced, or someone like Mitch, maybe another mentor, what sorts of things have you learned that you have not been able to learn in a school environment more about the outside world?
I would say the biggest thing I've learned from PC Caps is really just that, like, not everything you do is going to be accepted, even if you put forward, like, your best work. So I think like Shelby said earlier, you can't really tie yourself to your work too much. Because, like, so I guess, like, right now I'm working on a scheduling app for an event that PMI is going to hold. But I guess, like, I would assume that they're also having their own sort of backup plan if they wouldn't want to use my work. So I just think, like, you have to just look at everything from, like, an objective standpoint and, like, realize that maybe there's a better option than you, and just have to accept that sometimes. But you should always still work your hardest.
Mitch, do you stay within the disciplines of engineering, or do you talk about things outside engineering? For an example, Lynn and I have been doing this program for about 5 years, and the one common theme that we see reoccurring on a weekly basis with our guests is the importance of collaboration, being able to work with other disciplines. And so one of the things that comes out of that is being able to work in groups and being able to be a team player, that sort of thing. Do you talk about some of those disciplines that are not engineering disciplines, but they're just basic things that you need to do in the way of communicating and working with other people?
You know, I think that's a great point. That's definitely what I try to, one of the main things I also try to emphasize to the students is that, you know, when you go from job to job, you're going to have different types of work, but the common thing that you're always going to have is collaboration and teamwork that you need, whether through emails or putting meetings together, simple stuff like that. And, you know, a lot of our projects are with, you know, it's not necessarily all with the school, it's stuff within the city, or we're working with a university down in Salt Lake. We're also working with some private companies as well. So it's, you know, it's real world experience. And we're also working with other, the computer science, you know, to where it's like, you've got to work with their schedule and they're working with yours. So it's about communication and keeping everyone up to date. And like you say, teamwork. It's not a personal thing. So,
Jordan, I want to go back to something to this app that you're designing, a scheduling app. And what is PMI?
Project Management Institute. So they have a chapter in North Utah.
Okay. And so you're maybe in sync developing an app that they're, you know, they may be developing their own app at the same time. How long have you known how to develop and design an app?
So I first started really getting into programming 2 years ago. And I did it because I was going to go into an AP computer science class, and I was preparing for that. But I think I really started, like, getting into designing apps specifically probably last year after my AP computer science class. And I think PC Caps has allowed me to, like, relearn a lot of stuff that I might have forgotten over the summer and really develop myself further.
So before PC Caps, and it sounds like, I know this AP computer science class, I think they've only had it at the high school for about 3 years. Do you happen to know? I think that's right, because my kids were in Park City High School and they didn't have anything like that. Only, you know, a couple of years ago. And so I'm wondering, you know, do you feel like you have enough resources to do what you want to do, to learn in this field? Or do you think you're lacking something at the high school?
I think a lot of development as a programmer is going to happen when you're alone at your house. Because I think that's definitely when I've learned the most. But taking the classes in school is very important, because with the teacher instruction, it allows you to go home and really learn more yourself. So it's sort of like an exponential growth kind of thing. Because when you take more classes in school, you're going to feel a lot more comfortable at home, and you'll enjoy it more at home. So you'll do more programming at home. But I think currently the high school definitely has enough resources for anyone to really start programming and get into it.
Great.
Mitch, as you look at the program, PC Caps, what sorts of things are you in need of as our listeners are listening? Maybe they may want to get involved in mentoring or in helping out in some way. What sort of things could you tell our listeners out there that we're looking for or would help the program?
I think definitely mentors. You know, the more real world experience that can be shared with the students, it just helps the students, almost inspires them. They can see, it's one thing to learn something out of a textbook, but when you hear it from someone who's had that personal experience, I think they take it that much more and learn from that. So I think mentors is one, but also students. I would say, you know, if there's someone out there that you know that would be possibly interested, it's a good way to go ahead and get some direction. There's so many different directions you can go, even within engineering or computer science in your career, that taking, you know, a first step and trying something will give you the right direction. Even if it's not something you like, all right, well, then try something else. So I would say students and mentors.
And when you go to the PC Caps website, there are four threads that are identified. One is the digital design program. We talked to Shelby and Deb about that. And then there's, of course, engineering that we're talking about right now. It looks like there's a separate thread for software development. And there's a fourth thread, which is highlighted for teacher educational foundations. Are there other threads, or are those the majors?
I don't know. I think there's also a business strand, I believe.
Oh, that's correct. That's correct. There is a business.
Oh, yeah. So yeah. I think those are the major five, I guess.
Okay.
But I think software design and engineering seem to be the two most popular. Is that right?
Software is struggling right now.
Okay.
Like really bad.
But so, wait, yeah. Amazon needs to hire like 50,000 software developers.
Yeah, I think there might just be a lack of interest, I guess, in the high school. So next semester, I know we're not doing it because we didn't get enough interest. And last semester, I believe they didn't do it. So
We'd like to thank you both. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. But Mitch Vandegooch, who's the mentor engineering, formerly of Skull Candy, Jordan Stampley, who's speaking with us now, from the computer science discipline, and also earlier in the program, Shelby Porges and Deb Corrigan for digital design.
Thanks for joining us.
This is Cool Science Radio.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. Thank our underwriters, the Natural History Museum of Utah, Peak Art and Frame, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Park City Mountain, San Francisco Design, and Nexus IT. It's time to head into National Public Radio News from Washington. You're listening to KPCW, Park City.